We're always the richer if we think of ourselves as an Erev Rav right from the moment of leaving Egypt, and this is our story. We remain an Erev Rav, a mixed multitude of people who have different ways of falling in love with this Jewish tradition of ours.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our penultimate episode of this series. I can't believe Rabbi Debbie just did a shocked face because it does feel like it's gone really fast. It's been so great, this series. So thanks for coming along with us. We are so extraordinarily delighted and excited about being joined today by Rabbi Rebecca Burke, Rabbi Extraordinaire of Finchley Progressive Synagogue. You're joining us today to speak about all things conversion and being Jews by choice. We're really excited to have you here, a colleague and friend, having this conversation with us. Welcome to Rabbiting On.
Thank you. Rebecca, you know, we are breaking our one rule, one unwritten rule, which is Rebecca and I made it quite clear many years ago that we're never in the same place at the same time, because in any kind of civic or interfaith engagement, we were just that woman rabbi from Finchley. So as long as one of us was there, we both got credit for being there. Yeah. So we'd just divide and conquer. We'd always make sure only one of us went to anything.
Many weddings I have been thanked for that I wasn't actually present for. So yes, absolutely.
It's a great wedding in two places at once.
Yeah. I'm sorry that I don't get to talk about telly, because that's my favorite episode of yours. I had so much I would have joined in with. So,
what's the best thing you're watching at the moment, Rebecca?
So for me, right, so I just started Vladimir, which is a little bit too much, but Riot Women I watched, which was brutal and so distressing. And last night I watched Louis Theroux with my son in the Manosphere, which was terrifying. So I'm sharing things that aren't that relaxing.
No. But I'm not going to take any of this.
You're talking to the people that watch RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm always the one trying to
I know what you all like now. Yeah. No, but Miriam, you like a little bit more grittier political. But I know, Debbie likes a bit of sequins and, but I did love Banjo and Ro. Oh my gosh. I've even put my name on the list to be the first guest at the Grand Island Hotel. So yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh, they were so in love and beautiful, and
it was
Grandpa
gorgeous.
The dog, and yeah, that was very gorgeous.
Okay, good. So you are watching some uplifting TV.
I am watching relaxing as well as educational.
Educational and gritty. Yeah, we can hold all of that.
Yes.
Well, we're so happy you're here with us. How is everyone doing generally? We had a very stressful start to our podcast today because everyone was having tech issues and computer failures and headphones kind of self-combusting almost. So how are people doing generally? Debbie, how are you today?
I'm okay. Looking forward to Pesach and feel like I'm in that kind of prep mode of constantly trying to feed everyone around me things that I need to get rid of from my house so that we don't throw it away, because I won't throw food away. So this weekend, next week, in our house are known as Shabbat Hechametz, where the menu planning doesn't matter. You can have duck pancakes with a pasta bake as long as it's all hametz that gets eaten.
I love that. I love that you're excited as well. I have to say, I start getting panicky about Pesach at this time, but I'm glad that you're in a positive
space. It's a heady mix.
Yeah. How about you, Rebecca? How are you doing either in the run up to Pesach or just generally?
Yeah, generally good. Good. A little bit, a few little challenges around. Like my youngest son is a bit in grief at the moment, as a good friend of his died last week in traveling in Vietnam. And so it's really interesting how you navigate an 18-year-old feeling that shocking grief for the first time. So that is hanging over us. But in between, it's also that thing that life goes on, and I have another child who's traveling at the moment, so that raises anxiety. I'm noticing a lot of dust in my house this morning as the painter was there, so also thought, when will there be time for that deep clean between now and suddenly Pesach upon us? But good. Generally good.
It's a lot going on. So sending you strength mm-hmm. for all of that. Yeah. And thank life you. Goes on. It's good to be together
life
as well.
Life goes on.
Yeah. Yeah. Miriam, how are you doing? Because you've had the most biggest tech issues this morning.
I have. I'm holding that, but actually it feels like nothing in comparison to, I think, what we're all holding in terms of world events at the moment. We're recording this the day after I don't even know what to call it,
Michigan.
Incident in Temple Israel in Michigan. And I just, each time is not only another kick in the gut that makes me just want to weep, but also that feeling of when we make our lives about bringing people into community because we know what we can offer of such substance and beauty, the idea that those places could be also ones of danger just leave me feeling, you know, completely sick. And that idea of how do I keep convincing myself and the world that actually what we're giving each other is a place of security and comfort and other people who are going through this same trauma rather than a place where people are, you know, potentially in danger. Because I just can't bear to think of our synagogues or our schools or our nurseries as being that place.
Yeah, I really hear you. And I don't know whether I've shared, we had my twin niece and nephew had their B'nai Mitzvah at Heaton Park Synagogue in January. Mm. And it was the first simcha after the attack. And it was, I mean, it's not my synagogue, obviously, but we're very close. It's my sister's father-in-law is the chair, and he was there on the day and was a hero, really, stopped it being a lot worse than it was. And the rabbi was there being wonderful because our family is very integrated into that synagogue. And it was really hard to be in that space, to viscerally feel the after effects of it, to see people who had been shot there davening and being in the synagogue. And like you said, the kind of the implicit risk of coming to a sanctuary. And I couldn't quite hold the dichotomy of that, of what that meant. It felt so strange and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I guess it's a good segue in some ways to talk about today, Jews by choice, of converting into Judaism. Certainly it's a time where it feels hard to be Jewish in so many different ways, politically, physically, maybe, spiritually, certainly. And I think originally I particularly really wanted to talk about conversion because I think part of our rabbiting on purpose, not that we have one really, is to myth bust, as producer Dan put it, to talk about things like really what goes on when you're planning a wedding, for example, or, you know, how do we approach these issues? And conversion is one of these things that we have a custom of not talking about. We're not meant to share if someone has converted. And we don't often talk about what the process involves because it's in some ways quite a private, personal thing. But what that means is, do we really know what goes on outside of the conversations between the clergy and the person or the people converting? So we kind of wanted to talk about that. And maybe also we can feed in, like, why do people convert in these moments, in these times, given the kind of the difficulties and the risks involved in it and the beauty as well. So maybe we can get to that as well. So we're going to be here talking all things conversion. And maybe let's start by, I'd love to hear our favorite moments of being sponsoring clergy. That's what it's called. You're a sponsoring rabbi or sponsoring cantor, of helping someone from the beginning when they send the email, pluck up the courage and say, hi, Rabbi Rebecca, I'm interested in converting to Judaism. And then we take them all the way through to the Beit Din, which is the religious court, and then hopefully after into community and alongside them going forward. So do you have a standout moment for you of being a sponsoring rabbi?
I mean, I have a few. It really is, as you said, Robin, at the start, it's the most privileging part, really, of being a rabbi, a congregational rabbi, that someone chooses. The truth is, all of us choose every day of our lives to be Jewish, not to be Jewish, to lean in, to lean out. But actually, for anything to sustain itself, we have to keep choosing. But I find it so utterly humbling when someone approaches a community and wants it. And I think, as Miriam said, the price is high at the moment to do that. I think it's the same in other communities. I know that there was, hideous things happening in a mosque near you, Robin, where men were going into prayer. But I think a couple have been wonderful for me.
One person right now has been so rejected by the Orthodox Beit Din that I think she cannot believe the welcome and the warmth that she is finding within our community, not just through me, but with others alongside her. So that makes me super proud. I loved discovering that at the end of a year of study, of going for that engaging conversation at the Beit Din, and as I always say, the Beit Din is not so much a test as an opportunity for you to sell and explain how you fell in love with it, is to be able to take people to the women's pond at Kenwood for the mikveh. And I know that's very live here, having Miriam, who wants to ensure that there are beautiful opportunities for mikveh. So I think that freedom of realizing that one can integrate what sparks joy in one's life, even at the same time as going through this major ritual of becoming Jewish, was really moving for me. And then one last one that stands out is an Italian woman was converting with us, and she was pregnant with twins. We had to ensure she couldn't go to the mikveh straight away, just in case the mikveh brought on her birth. And she went into the Beit Din, and all I'll say is they were quite challenging rabbis on the court that day.
No.
And I couldn't.
Well, now we're all trying to guess which of our colleagues it was.
Yeah. But oh my goodness, she just seduced them. And when I was invited back in, they said, we've never had someone talk about Spinoza and how to make challah at the same Beit Din moment. So I think I've had many, and it is my favorite part of really being a congregational rabbi. But those are a few that stand out for me. The women's pond, Spinoza, challah, finding your right denomination, being a student rabbi and sitting at the Reform Beit Din at the top of the Sternberg Center with the late, wonderful Sylvia Morris helping and the late Rodney Mariner presiding, and seeing a doodle from Colin Eimer saying, here I am making Jews again. Aww. And that stayed with me as a student.
Thank you so much for sharing. It really uplifts, doesn't it? The privilege, as you say, and the kind of hidden moments that we don't, you know, quite rightly talk about publicly, but actually sharing them is really important. Debbie, do you have any favourite moments from being a sponsoring rabbi?
Oh, gosh, so many. And I remember one Beit Din I sat on, wasn't my candidate at all, but someone laned the Torah portion for the week in their Beit Din interview, which I thought was setting the bar really high. That's just for those of you on this journey, that's not an expectation that anyone has of you. I think one of the really special things that we get to do is there are lots of people who come for lots of different reasons, from, you know, falling in love with Judaism through falling in love with a partner to just discovering Judaism in their life. And there's also a really strong strand of people who are trying to reattach a branch of the tree. So, Soviet rule or the Holocaust has, or sometimes even the 1492 expulsion of Jews from Spain has cut a branch off the tree. And people have, you know, found a connection back into that heritage and want to reattach it. So they undergo both a conversion and a return. Mm. And that sense of reattaching the branch to the tree, I find really special. And sometimes I've found, more often than I would have imagined, people discover, after beginning the journey, some kind of Jewish ancestry. My very first conversion candidate in my first job is someone I'm still in touch with, even though they've moved to America now. They were German and woke up aged 14 and said, you know what? I really am interested in this Jewish stuff, which is quite common in Germany. There's a lot of really interesting journeys that go on because of the history there. And age 14, she started investigating the local synagogues and trying things out, found they weren't often the most welcoming or the right thing for her. And then aged 18, chose to travel to America to be a nanny in order to live with a Jewish family and experience that. And unfortunately chose a family that didn't keep anything and weren't at all interested in their Judaism. So after a year of that, moved to London and joined our synagogue, went on the program. And halfway through the program, started talking about the fact that her mum had mentioned that growing up, they knew her grandmother had been in a concentration camp, but they didn't know why. And her mum had kind of survived, really, by starting a relationship with one of the guards. and had ended up marrying a Nazi guard.
Gosh.
She never spoke about being Jewish. They didn't know if she was Jewish, but she never mixed milk and meat, and they never had pork in the house. And I said to her, you know, you could really do some research. There is some very good documentation kept, and find out if actually halachically you do have a Jewish line. And her response was, you know what? I'm not interested. This is my journey. I chose this and I want to do it for me. The history is interesting, but it's not why I want to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was so fascinating and beautiful. And the strength of connection that people who've really lent into choosing this for themselves is such a beautiful thing.
Wow. What a story. And I think, I mean, that's part of the privilege, isn't it? Of when you, because as rabbis and cantors, we both sponsor candidates to the Beit Din on that journey. But we also sit, as you've said, on the Beit Din to hear people's journeys. And I think that can be, as you're sharing that person's story, that can be the most moving thing of the disparate journeys as well. Miriam, do you have any favourite moments that speak to you in this moment?
I mean, you know, I also really value it as part of the role and an extraordinary privilege. And I think it was one of the things that also sort of has helped me with the whole kind of fertility part of my life, which is, yes, kind of biologically, I've brought one child into the Jewish world, but actually all of those months sat on the Beit Din, all of those conversion students that I have sponsored, there feels like that other sense of like, of kind of a little piece of that. Of there are many ways that we can pru uravu and be fruitful and multiply, like many ways of being able to kind of add to the world in a certain way. And kind of it feels a privilege to be able to say, you know, there are some people that found their Jewish life because I happen to be sat on their Beit Din. I think for me, the real privilege and the real sort of interest is piqued by the series of what you can only describe as weird coincidental moments that put together, there's a piece of me that just goes, you've kind of always been Jewish. And it's not genetic and it's not biological and it's not about a broken family tree. It's just you will always seem to be destined to be here. And yet that's kind of even feels strange coming out of my mouth because, you know, in that way, that's not the God I believe in and yet sort of thing. So, you know, my favorite story, and I'm sure she won't mind me telling this story on the podcast, is a gorgeous South African woman who I walked into a mobile phone shop many years ago to, you know, read whatever my contract on my mobile phone. And one of the boxes that she was ticking in the woman behind the counter was filling out a form. And one of the things she asked me, or maybe I gave her my email address, was my job. And she just looked at me and went, "You're a rabbi. I feel like I've been waiting for you to come here." And she'd grown up in South Africa. And in South Africa, you don't start school until you're six. Except the Jewish schools start a year early for, I'm not sure why, they just happen to. And she was very bright and her parents decided she needed to start school early. So from the age of four, she went to Jewish day school all the way through to 18. She had a Hebrew name. She went to multiple B'nai Mitzvah. You know, she was just part of the Jewish community because her parents had made this somewhat unusual decision to send her for 14 years to a Jewish school. And she'd kind of always thought, It's weird. I know so much and I feel so Jewish and yet I know I'm not. And by that very coincidence of just being in, you know, a rabbi walking into her workplace, she then started the conversion process formally, but already came with such a depth of knowledge because she really, through her school friends and through her learning at school, had been living a Jewish life. And it's that kind of the difference in quite how much people know when they start the journey. And then there's some people whose, you know, experiences of their, you know, their boyfriend or girlfriend who happens to be Jewish and their kind of practices. And maybe it's all about Friday night dinner and chicken soup with the in-laws to be. And other people, I mean, one student from the day one of her adjoining our gateway to Judaism classes, I was sitting there thinking, really, she could be teaching this class better than me. She was so well-versed and so knowledgeable. And she was actually, you know, my first and very privileged moment to give smicha to someone many years later. And that not only did she go through Gateway, but then she became a rabbi and is now a colleague. And that idea that actually opening the door for the Gateway course has opened her to then be creating Jewish lives. And you know, it's a very beautiful, privileged part of our role.
Yeah, I have a feeling that each of us could talk about all of these experiences for days, because you can kind of feel the beauty in it and all of the intricacies of it. I'll really briefly share one of my favorite moments was a couple who were both Jewish and had adopted a little baby boy who was just the most gorgeous boy ever, and had been turned away from the Orthodox communities for ensuring that he had Jewish status, because they were asked to jump through so many hoops without any kind of date of when they would be able to say that he was Jewish. And they lived very Jewish lives, very normative Jewish lives in a lot of ways. And my greatest job, I always said, as a community rabbi, was being able to say, yes, come on in, we'd love to have you. Part of the process for adoption is just a kind of like just a recognition. So they just kind of rock up to the Beit Din, to our religious court. And he played on the floor with the rabbis. We all come and sat with the baby, and well, he's a bit older then. And he blew the shofar for us. He told us the Hebrew letters he could read. And it was so positive and moving and joyful and celebratory and so important. So that's one of my kind of favorite moments.
It's a great example also of when actually I don't feel comfortable setting the bar much higher for our converts than people who happen to be born Jewish.
Exactly.
So like if that couple had happened, you know, to biologically have given birth to that child, nothing would have, you know, there would have been no question about that child's status. But because they happened to go through the adoption process in order for that to be, you know, their son, their child, all of a sudden, other Batei Din, you know, Orthodox Beit Din, are putting all of these kind of contingencies, you know, well, if you do this or if you do that. And it just feels so immoral and so unfair. You know, who is to say what a Jew is in that moment?
I remember a few years ago, Jonathan Friedland wrote an article in the JC responding to Yossi Beilin on the Knesset, saying there should be a secular, cultural, relaxed way to convert to Judaism, because we expect so much for those to go down that religious route and do so with such great profundity. And yet there are many wonderful folk within our communities who've been woken by that kind of cultural path. And yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Miriam, on that one. I also think we as rabbis often get a new shot of adrenaline or enthusiasm for our own faith by people that come in and teach us new things or show a new enthusiasm or interest in certain parts of Jewish life. And that's why we're always the richer if we think of ourselves as an Erev Rav right from the moment of leaving Egypt. And this is our story. We remain an Erev Rav, a mixed multitude of people who have different ways of falling in love with this Jewish tradition of ours.
Yeah, I definitely feel that when I'm on the Beit Din. It's like a reminder of, oh, yeah, there is something that is so gorgeous about our traditions.
It's funny. When Ben, my son, was about three, he ended up on a Northern Line tube station chatting to one of the tube drivers in the most animated and excited, like he'd been meeting his absolute hero, this tube driver, because like this was a real life, like actual tube driver. And as the conversation finished, this guy looked at me and just went, "He's absolutely made my day. I've been doing this job for 30 years and I was so sick and tired of it. And now I remember how I felt when I first, you know, wanted to be a driver and I was really thrilled by this job." And it's that kind of thing of, you know, especially in the world at the moment, so full of misery and anti-Semitism and fear and a polarized Jewish community who are so locked in battle with each other and the rest of the world, having those people step up and say, you know, please, would it be possible to join you? It does really give that nudge of like, you see what people want to be part of.
Yeah,
that reminder.
I'm often struck by that sense of how ancient that round of feelings is. Conversion has become much, much harder over the centuries. Even in progressive Judaism, I think we make it much harder than it was in the time of the Talmud, when there were literally five questions and the answer to all of them was yes. But one of those questions was, do you align your destiny with that of the Jewish people, even though we are so persecuted and hated? And it's sort of a reminder, I suppose, that this isn't anything new. This has always been part of that journey. And there's been an astonishing uptick in some ways post October 7th in people standing up and saying, I need to do this. Some who'd been thinking about it for a while and some for whom that moment was just a wake up. I remember one Bet Din last year where I think about 50% of the people who came mentioned October 7th as part of their journey into this process. Although one of them, who really impressed me, said, you know, she'd started coming along to the classes not intending to convert, just wanting to learn a bit about her partner's tradition and grow a bit. And she wore something called an aura ring, which is like a kind of, it's like the smartwatch, but it only measures your health biometrics. And she said she would look at her biometrics at the end of every week. And the time she was calmest and had the lowest blood pressure was Friday between 6:30 and 7:30 when she was sitting in services.
Wow.
And that was what convinced her that this was the right thing for her. So that sense of actually, this is good for me. It was so lovely to learn.
That's amazing.
She kind of got a prescription for Judaism, didn't she?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's a good way of putting it. And that captures some of the diversity, doesn't it, of why people want to convert or return. We also give certificates of return or recognition in Bet Din. And it might be worth just really quickly saying that the process of conversion is pretty much standard across progressive synagogues. You come to synagogue for a certain amount of time, then you'll go through learning, often about a year of being with other people, kind of learning the ins and outs of Judaism. So what is Pesach? What do we do? Why do we do it like this? But also holistically, trying out and integrating Jewish practice into your home and into your week as well, becoming part of the community, coming to services, is a very immersive experience. So that's around 18 months before then. And you'd meet with the rabbi or the cantor several times during that period and eventually making it to the Beit Din, where you would have a conversation with hopefully very non-challenging clergy at the Beit Din, have a mikveh for the ritual bath. Circumcision we have different practices across progressive Judaism, but sometimes encouraged or not for people who are male going through. And then that mikveh is the final.
Never ever for women, though. Mm. Let's be clear.
Yeah, really, it did sound really like you clear. Were sometimes
oh,
encouraging
no,
it for men,
God.
But for women, it was always
okay.
It's just a choice for women. No,
just to be super clear, it's just for men. But that's, we have a kind of divergence of practice around that in some ways. And then the dunk at the end is the you are Jewish and. Then you get usually a little blessing in synagogue to show, to kind of celebrate that in community. We're really lucky that we have a super listener, Kevin, who we're so happy has agreed to give us a little bit of a voice note about his own journey into Judaism. So we're going to have a little bit of a listen now, because we know there are loads of different journeys. We've already started to share a few of them into Judaism. And maybe we could have a listen to Kevin telling us his journey and reflect a little bit on that. And then also all the different trends that we're seeing of people stepping into Judaism.
So I grew up in one of the most unethnically diverse areas of the country, with no reason to be interested in Judaism and no Jewish community. But when I heard the word Jewish, it immediately meant something to me, just like a few years before I'd heard the word gay and knew that that meant something to me too. It was a few years later that I received a copy of Gay Times with a guy in there who was from North London and Jewish, which told me that it was possible to be gay and Jewish at the same time. But he'd been having a horrendous experience having been sent for conversion therapy. That word conversion was one of the things that put me off converting for quite a while. Life went on. I spent many years trying to go to Israel and then cancelling. I eventually went there, went to the Kotel, and my experience at the Kotel, trite as it may sound, but those in the know will know, a voice simply said to me, "What are you waiting for?"
Wow.
Oh, I mean, wow.
It's amazing. And it's amazing because I think when you have been born into a Jewish family and taken it for granted, knowing that that kind of joyous sort of "it's you" moments happen for other people is quite extraordinary. I'd love to know what sort of percentage of our converts have that kind of experience rather than a sort of, you know, relationship that's like, well, this would be nice, or this would be easier for our family, or, you know, I'd really like to get married under a chuppah, please will you, kind of thing. Fascinating, totally amazing story. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. I think it was really interesting because Kevin also captures a trend that the conveners of our Bat Din, so Rabbi Jonathan Remain and Rabbi Mark Solomon and Margaret Jacoby, all these great rabbis who make sure we have really supportive and gorgeous Bat Din, there is definitely a trend towards not so much people joining Judaism because they have a Jewish partner and it's kind of, you know, it makes sense in some ways and they find their way into Judaism through that process. But people like Kevin, who for the sake, we say lishma, just for the sake of it, being called towards it without actually having any Jewish ancestry or even Jewish friends or experiences, but it's speaking very deeply. And I think it's very moving. I kind of got shivers when Kevin said, you know, that Jewish just, it meant, it was a descriptor for him without even being really at the beginning of that journey. So it speaks to this trend that we're seeing of people feeling called to Judaism for its own sake rather than for anything else.
I think the question of people joining because they're getting married is a really interesting one. I think we're seeing a lot less of it now than we did. But I remember as a student rabbi being in a community outside London and a family asking my husband, "When did Debbie convert?" Because the assumption was if you're progressive, yeah, you've converted. And that was, or you've married someone who doesn't quite fit the norm, because otherwise, why wouldn't you be Orthodox? And that really lit a fire in me of, no, I am a proud progressive Jew, regardless. Like, and the idea that you would only be progressive because you've converted. But actually, I love what Rebecca was saying about how we're all really Jews by choice, right? We've all chosen to lean into what it is to be Jewish. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who's the famous Orthodox Jewish feminist husband, Blue Greenberg's husband, says that post-Holocaust, the covenant is broken. And therefore, we are all Jews by choice if we show up, if we are part of community. We're all choosing to be in that covenant. And I think that is such a helpful analogy of what it is to come into this people. But I don't know about you guys. I've never converted someone who is planning to get married who hasn't, by the end of the process, if not the beginning, felt this was theirs, mm-hmm, and they would do it regardless of their partner. No one by the end of the process is doing this for someone else. And usually at the beginning of the process, they're not doing it for someone else. It's always got to come from something in them where they found a love of leaning into this tradition because of the person that they love who's introduced them to it.
Yeah. And they've fallen in love with Judaism with the person. Like, I think the Judaism is part of the attraction in some ways.
Just to say something in response to Debbie, which is so interesting, that often the person converting brings their Jewish partner back into the fold of Judaism.
Absolutely.
And sometimes if they're from a different Jewish background, then there's this whole wonderful thing of crafting and creating a new Jewish life for those two people. Like, there's extra things that are being added to them as a couple. I was just going to say that there are a few slight differences in the liberal tradition. And of course, we're looking forward to being under one Bet Din, and there's no reason not to. But we have traditionally asked our candidates to write two essays as a way of being able to focus their learning, their interest, and to be able to have that point of conversation when they get to the Bet Din. And the first essay is a slightly elongated response to that paragraph of why now, why do you want to be Jewish? And I really see that people really enjoy whether they have an academic background or not. I always say none of the rabbis on the Beit Din will thank you for a thesis. So do not feel the pressure to write a long piece of work. But then it means that their second essay is often something that totally reflects them and their particular curious, idiosyncratic way they're going to engage with their Judaism. So someone recently wasn't sure she could convert because she had tattoos, and in the end wrote the most amazing essay about understanding where that, you know, where the discouragement came from, of her own journey of feeling nervous about being in a synagogue because she'd chosen to have tattoos, even though her Jewish partner did as well. And it was beautiful. Someone else was from Poland and wrote a whole thing about the Jews of Krakow and what that meant for her to take on that tradition. Someone else was a musician or a chef. And I think I really like that. And I know initially people think it's going to be much harder. And I wonder whether because of that, there is a slight easier route around Hebrew and reading Hebrew at the Beit Din. So I got to sit in on the Reform, that still is Reform Beit Din, where Miriam was one of the rabbis sitting on the court. And yeah, there's a little more adrenaline of reading a passage of Hebrew, whereas ours is a little bit more relaxed around that.
Although I have seen that Hebrew change just even in my rabbinate, that it used to be much more of a kind of sense of the rabbi, one of the rabbis on the Beit Din would randomly pick a page number and say,
yeah,
can you read this?
Terrifying.
Now it's much more of a sense of, is there a piece of Hebrew that's kind of meaningful for you that means it's a little bit more practiced? And it sort of takes you back a bit to what I was saying about where the bar is compared to people who have been born Jewish and not, that there's something around, is there Hebrew that you've kind of picked up from your year or so of coming regularly to shul? And therefore, you know, this is a piece of liturgy I now recognize and I can now slowly read on my own, rather than just, you know, randomly choose any page and I'll be able to sight read, which I would say, you know, the vast majority of people in community, you know, can't do. What you were saying about the Jewish partners being brought in, I do love the fact that most of our shuls, I think, if they're teaching in classes, also encourage if there's a Jewish partner to come along too. So that actually as a couple, you are both learning about Judaism in an adult way. So you're not relying on your kind of pediatric Jewish knowledge of like, well, this is what we learned at Cheder, so it must be true. But rather, as a couple, thinking about, well, what does our Jewish life look like? So let's learn about Kashrut or let's learn about Shabbat and see how we then put that into our lives, rather than going, well, my parents always did it this way, so that's what we now have to do. And kind of gets it always be the Jewish partner's Judaism rather than kind of now two established adults approaching Judaism in their own way.
Yeah,
I think that Jewish home that everyone tries to build for themselves and the couple trying to figure out what their Jewish home looks like, as everyone does, ties in really beautifully with the Hebrew piece, actually, because it's, for me, the learning Hebrew, you know, often our students end up knowing more Hebrew than a lot of people who are born Jewish, but it allows them to sit in a service or to be at home and to not feel that they're somehow on the outside of all this language that's going on. The vast majority of British Jews don't know what they're saying, but they've been saying it for so long that they know to say it. And I think that sense of what it is to be part of the whole, and to craft that for yourself in a meaningful way. What are the choices that I need to make to live a meaningful Jewish life in my own way? And Hebrew is just one element of how you do that. The kashrut, the Shabbat, all of it is about making the choices of what I'm going to do that will be meaningful. I always say to my candidates before they go to the Beit Din, remember what you do know, don't panic about what you don't. Or remember what you do, don't panic about what you don't. Because we're not looking for people to show us that they do absolutely everything ever written, but that they've understood the choices they're making and that they're meaningful in their lives, because we want Judaism to be meaningful in everyone's lives.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the conversation at the Beit Din are about as well. When we get to that moment, the religious court, the house of judgment, we're literally translating it, is that the rabbis sitting on the Beit Din really want to see how people are enjoying and integrating Judaism into their lives. I often like to ask the question, you know, like, what Jewish values play out in your work, for example, if someone's in work, you know, what does it mean to you to be Jewish as a nurse, as a whatever you might be? And it's, the Beit Din really are trying to capture what Jewish identity looks like. And there is some knowledge. We want to check that, you know, people know some stuff, but really the conversation is about expressing that Judaism. I want to return to one of the themes that we picked up on earlier about the kind of stigma, Debbie, you spoke about in some, certainly historically, and I think in some communities still now, progressive or otherwise, there is this really awful stigma of what it is to convert into Judaism, that in some ways it's an inferior status. And we know very clearly, like from our rabbinic literature and teaching historically, once Jewish, always Jewish. You were there standing at Sinai with everyone else. And whether you were born Jewish or Jew by choice, there's no discrimination. It's a flat, you know, an equal bed. We're all in it together. But that often doesn't play out culturally. People will like to kind of note who's converted or maybe think there's a lesser kind of a groundedness, which is really awful. And I feel very strongly and angrily about it. And it's really important that Jewish communities are shaped by the people who join us. We become so much richer for it. So for our last voice note, we've got a really exciting entry from Rabbi Kath Vardy, my very good friend, because we were ordained together, studied together for 5 years, and she's now up in Manchester with me, which is brilliant. And she's going to share her story of entering Judaism and then entering the rabbinate. So let's hear what Rabbi Kath has to say and maybe open up a little bit about what it is to break that stigma down in our communities.
Stepping into Judaism was transformative for me because I discovered a way of moving through the world that offered a richness and a spiritual depth I hadn't encountered before. Becoming a rabbi then feels like simply continuing this journey, only now I get to share it with others as they find their own unique pathways to bring Jewish meaning and purpose to their lives. Coming into the rabbinate as a Jew by choice, though, is not without its challenges. Our pathways in are varied, and inevitably they occupy a very different space, for we are both insiders and outsiders. I don't see this as an impediment, however, because I do think that it is a gift. Because I really do believe that for Jewish community to thrive, perhaps we might do well to recognise that we all occupy this liminal place of insider, outsider in different areas of our lives. And so perhaps rather than bringing just worry or a sense of incoherent dislocation, we can perhaps instead harness our sense of pending fragility to feed our awareness and our capacity for compassion, creativity, and community. So maybe that's what I'm trying to do as a rabbi who is also a Jew by choice, because I believe that ultimately we need community that can hold difference and not try to extinguish it.
Wow. I love that, because I think what Rabbi Kath's shone a light on there is that talking about conversion and us being privileged enough to experience people's journeys or being Jews by choice ourselves, is that there is no such thing as a proper Jew or a proper way of being Jewish. And I think we fall into that trap maybe when we take it for granted or whatever, but actually recognizing that we're all different, we're all inside outsiders, we all feel like we belong and don't belong, or we, you know, feel that we're not doing things right or wrong, and actually kind of disrupting what is right or wrong Jewishly, I think is really powerful. So it's great to hear from Rabbi Kath on that.
There's a letter that Maimonides, and this is my favorite thing that exists Jewishly, really, that there is a letter that he wrote to someone known as Ovadia, which which is really from the root eved, slave, which is the word that the name that people often take on or used to as someone who was converting. And of course, then I thought, oh, Abdullah in Islam is often a name that people take on when they convert. But in this letter, he seems to be responding to a concern by Ovadia, saying, how can I say the God of our ancestors when they're not my ancestors? How can I include myself in the blessing? And Maimonides' response is so incredibly inclusive, including and welcoming. And I love studying that, not actually just with people on the conversion journey, but with folk in the synagogue to show that it was always meant to be thus. And I find it really interesting about the admission ceremony, that sense of privacy, but also celebration of welcoming a new member into the community. And we always do them just before the service begins, but it's everyone who arrives to the service is aware it's just happened. But I always think about that. It's such a big moment of us as a congregation saying, we are so glad you're here. And it has been this way since Maimonides is writing.
That's so interesting. I think these ceremonies are done so differently by everybody. I know at EHRS for many years, they were almost always done privately. And I'd always done them publicly in my previous communities, as had my colleagues. And obviously, we give people the option not to do it publicly. But it's the community love it. They really value the celebration of someone who has chosen to become part of them, which I think is also quite different, as Robin was inferring earlier, to what it was like when I was growing up. There was often a sort of, oh, have they got any Yiddish kite, though, which is such a ridiculous phrase, you know, yeah. Sephardi family have any Yiddish kite, right? What does that even mean? And this person has learned far more than many will ever in their lifetime. And the opportunity to celebrate that and to welcome people is such a wonderful thing. I've had in the last sort of 6-7 years, one candidate who absolutely wanted it secret. No one must ever know, you know, I'm just a Jew. But other than that, it's a really special culmination of the journey to stand before the community you've become part of and say, you know, I'm here, I'm present, and thank you for welcoming me. And I hope I can be part of what we are going forward.
It's also that sense of being given your Hebrew name, sort of as the beginning of the kind of ritual journey within community life as well. You know, here's the Hebrew name, so that even though you've been kind of part of services on this journey, what does it mean now to be able to be called to Torah in a different way and to be sort of taking this next step into a kind of active religious role in a different way? I think it's a lovely transitional moment. And I think that community, in the same way as they love to celebrate with our B'nai Mitzvah that they've watched grow up and then go, boom, I can't believe you're now at this point. There's that thing of when you've watched someone's entry and tentative steps into community, being able to say, I've done it, now let's walk the journey together.
Yeah. And it's a way of breaking that stigma as well, isn't it? By celebrating in community. But I mean, we've not even had a chance to talk about. We've talked about conversion and certificates of return. So if you had Jewish ancestry or Judaism in your family, that we recognize a return or a recognition. But there's also a patrilineal status, which we probably need a whole other episode to talk about, because we've got a variety of difference, again, between liberal and reform, Bate Din, that's the plural for the religious courts. If your father's Jewish, so you've got a non-Jewish mother and a Jewish father, which is the opposite to me, because I have a non-Jewish, if you didn't know, I've got a non-Jewish father and a Jewish
you've
father.
You've never mentioned
I've not said it enough this series. So, you know, there's difference in, it's called inherited status in the Reform Beit Din. There's a kind of a process. There's a spectrum of process depending on where you are. It's much more open and equal in liberal Judaism. And I want to get to a point where we recognize, you know, you're just Jewish if you've got a Jewish father or a Jewish mother. That's where I'd like us to all be, and there's no process involved, but maybe that will happen at some point. So there are loads of different pathways, and the baked in really is a chance to get the kind of formal status of being able to say that the community recognizes, because being Jewish isn't something that you identify as. It's not an individual thing of like, right, I'm gonna, you know, actually like being a vegan, you know, I'm now going to be Jewish. There is an element of that, of you having to step in and to give yourself permission and to step into it. But Judaism is gifted through the community. It's the community seeing and saying you're welcome. And that's an ancient thing. Judaism has never been a closed community. I mean, we've never been evangelical. We've never gone out to say, please be Jewish. We don't stand on street corners. And like historically, especially in more Orthodox communities, it's very difficult to become Jewish. You're really made to jump through hoops. You're refused a certain amount of times. It's kind of an indefinite amount of time until you convert. But in progressive Judaism, as I think we've all shared, we're all delighted. Like, really? Come on in. Tell us your story. And how can we be shaped and, you know, our Judaism be enriched through you coming into your Judaism? But that textual and that theological basis for people living with Jews and becoming Jewish has been part of our history from the beginning. It's in the Torah. It's and it's become more formalized as well. It's a really gorgeous place to be. I think we've had such an interesting conversation. I'm sure our listeners will find it interesting, because I think it is something that we should be talking about more, actually, and celebrating. It's really something that we should be proud of and excited by as well, especially maybe because of the times we're in at the moment. This is something to uplift. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so lovely. It feels like you've always been part of Rabbiting On. Yeah.
I'm glad we broke our rule, Rebecca. It's nice to be in the same place at the same time.
Well, energetically on the screen, I guess we're still safe, aren't we?
Yeah, you're still safe. You're not in the same room. So weirdly, we've got one episode left and we're doing a super exciting special episode. I'm not going to say more now, but we're really excited about it and also probably a bit anxious, but we'll see how it goes. But I'm going to leave it as a cliffhanger because I think that will be best. Please do follow us on Instagram. It's at rabbiting_on_podcast. And I'm going to have to remind myself, that is definitely the thing. At rabbiting_on_podcast. Please do also rate us. Go to your podcasting app and find the stars. Give us 5. I think I can just say that. Just give us the most. Say how great we are. If you're listening, you must think that. Because it's a really great way of sharing. That's how podcasts grow. And we want to keep growing. So thank you all for being with us. And we'll see you for our special final of this series episode very shortly. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.